Welcome to the podcast for Boomer Women, where we embrace the journey. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. It's interesting to be this age and think you have some grasp of a subject, which allows you to have opinions on different aspects of that subject. That was sort of the case as I prepared for my conversation today. I admit right up front I don't know a lot about the topic, and within minutes, Peter has framed it in such a way that blew my opinions right out of the water. 70-plus years ago, Peter J. Bonney was the successful outcome of assisted reproduction. And yes, the term successful outcome comes with air quotes. This has been his life focus for decades now, so he is well-versed on many aspects of ART, assisted reproductive technology, both medical and ethical. My conversation today with Peter is really thought-provoking, and I hope you have your eyes opened to what is becoming pretty common practice in reproduction. Listen now. Today I'm back in the world of I don't know much about this subject. When I don't know much about a topic, I think my questions seem to bounce around a bit. Please bear with me, and I'm asking that of my guest today, too. Assisted reproductive technology, ART. On the CDC website, it says, in general, ART procedures involve surgically removing eggs from a woman's ovaries, combining them with sperm in the laboratory, and returning them to a female patient or a gestational carrier. ART also includes egg and embryo cryopreservation, which is freezing, and egg and embryo donation. The most common type of ART is in vitro fertilization. I have some really specific questions for Peter, so I'm not going to natter on here. Peter J. Bonney, welcome to the podcast for Boomer Women, where we embrace the journey.
Thanks for the invitation.
You have a really personal story around assisted reproduction. Would you share as much as you're comfortable sharing, please?
Sure. Well, I learned a lot more about this than I ever expected. At age 49, I really thought that I knew the fabric of my being. Was I adaptable because I had a dysfunctional childhood, moved a lot? Was I collaborative in my leadership style because of my Vietnam War experience? And was I successful because of a college education? All three of those, I thought, really impacted my persona. I always took my DNA for granted. But here at age 49, my mom had a post-operative stroke after open-heart surgery and spilled the beans that my dad, who had been dead for 33 years, wasn't biological. He was actually sterile, and I was the fabric of a anonymous sperm donor with some Harvard University auspices in the waning days of World War II. How was that for a shock to the system?
I can't imagine. No, I can only imagine, but I can't. Absolutely can't. Now, did anyone else in your family know?
No, my mother said that her mother knew, and that was it. And they carried that secret with them. My dad, of course, knew.
Were you angry about the facts of your conception or about the family secrecy?
Well, you know, this was a complex feeling and a rage of emotions that happened all at the same time. My dad took his own life when I was 16. He was mentally ill, suffering from unipolar depression. He was hospitalized for the last 4 years of his life. Old school Italian family, they said, well, let's keep that quiet. Don't let that spill over onto us. So then suicide by itself creates a wound that never heals. I never really properly grieved for my dad. And I had this secretive feeling that maybe I was flawed too. And I was going to do all that I could in my adult being to be strong and resourceful and independent and successful and never have anyone think that I'm flawed. So the whole thing was a shock to my system. I was angry. I was relieved. I was grieving. I had this rage of emotions all at the same time. How can you be happy and sad all at the same time? So it was very confusing.
Your mom was really ill. I can only imagine the two emotions of being angry that she'd kept that secret all these years, But also, after almost 50 years, she was your mom, and you were probably worried about her.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Like I said, it was a confusing period of time.
Your sperm donor made his contribution 70 plus years ago. Do you know what the process was at that time compared to now?
Well, it was all secretive. It was anonymous. It was a live specimen. Today, they freeze things and take it out of a laboratory. But it was a live exercise. He apparently went into the doctor's office a little before my parents. I dropped his specimen off and left again.
So I had a question about the term anonymous donor, whether that means somebody literally just walks in, makes his donation, and walks out again, or whether it just means that there is complete privacy around. I mean, they know who he is, they know a little bit about him, and there's just complete privacy around him.
Well, the practice at the time was the doctor making overtures and recruiting sperm donors when needed. And he was obviously one who was recruited. And had he donated before, had he donated since? None of that I knew at the time.
Did anybody? Like any of the clinics? Or?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Would there be any... we have computers now, so everything's so simple, or relatively. But I'm just wondering, would there have been any way for him to go into a clinic because he was going to college there? He gets a job cross country. He goes into some clinics there. Like, there'd be no way of tracing all of his donations, shall we say?
No way of tracing, and only the doctor knew. Only that specific doctor knew. If he went through another doctor, that other doctor wouldn't know.
Has that changed with computers nowadays? Do you know?
Well, things are done through sperm banks today, for the most part. And, of course, there are records, but there's no guarantee that anyone will be known. There's no law saying somebody has to be disclosed. There's no law regarding anonymity.
Can you address the whole topic of privacy, confidentiality for the donor? I'm going to get into the other side of the coin in a minute, but I'm just wondering, there's probably several reasons why a man would consider being a donor. Does he deserve complete anonymity, or is there need to be, he needs to be in that database and findable?
Well, let's talk about anonymity. Science doesn't care about anonymity. And the fact is that science disables anything regarding anonymity today, given consumer internet DNA testing. Anyone who thinks that they're anonymous is not dealing with the reality of the day. Anonymity is off the boards in terms of a term today because of DNA testing over the internet. In the old days, it was all a very hush-hush secret. The doctor said, don't tell anybody, keep this a secret. Just between you and your husband, if you're talking to, you know, the woman and a man. The donor doesn't know where the sperm went, so he might be knowledgeable about giving a donation, but he's not knowledgeable about where it went. The practice in reality was my birth certificate was a fraud. You know, the doctor was told. The obstetrician was told that my mom's husband was the father of the child. My birth certificate has his last name. Nobody was the wiser. It was an administrative solution to a technical problem they had conjured up. And that was the practice. And that's been the practice for a long, long time.
And it is still the practice today, is it?
It can be practiced today just that way, although sociology has moved on. To be a little bit more open regarding the requirements for infertilization.
You spoke in one of the interviews that I listened to about, because of that anonymity, because of the secrecy, could you ever have dated basically your stepsister. You have sister? Half-sister.
Well, there have been cases where people have discovered that. Most recently, there was a 30-year-old woman who discovered that her boyfriend in high school on a prom date in her first intimate experience was actually a half-sibling from the same sperm donor. So that's always a possibility. For me, I was raging with this term genealogical bewilderment. I learned that in psychology class in the mid-60s. Principally around the term used for adopted people that are having some difficulty in terms of their sense of belonging. In the old days, they called sperm donation semi-adoption, you know, a way to make it a little bit more socially acceptable to do. I was semi-adopted. I was feeling all of that rage of genealogical bewilderment. What was my genealogy? If I wasn't Northern Italian, what was I? I don't know. What was my health history? A big void. Half of me was a total void. And did I have any siblings? Did I ever date a sibling? Or even much worse, I just didn't know the answers to those things. And that genealogical bewilderment actually drove me to do the research that I did on the entirety of the sociological, the scientific, and the legal history and the evolution of assisted reproductive technology. There were no records kept. I just couldn't find anything. So as a defense mechanism for myself, I just did a deep dive of research into the entire field.
When did you start that?
Started that in 1996.
And I'm just showing off my lack of knowledge here. When did DNA testing start?
In 2008, 23andMe was the first company to offer consumer DNA testing over the internet. Actually, Time magazine named 23andMe the innovation of the year, the invention of the year in 2008. And by then, I was working in venture capital, and I had an advisory board that was all excited about this new technology that would enable personalized medicine. DNA and do a medical science according to your DNA. So personalized medicine is going to be a big field. They didn't know it. I kept it very quiet, but I was very excited to be one of the early customers of 23andMe, thinking I might be able to find my paternal seed. Well, being an early customer, the database of customers hadn't really grown. I learned that I wasn't Northern Italian. I was English, French, and a sliver of Scandinavian. Well, I could live with that, but I just didn't know still the source of my seed. I thought, let me just wait a little while. And as that customer base grows, eventually somebody is going to show up. Well, 9 years later, very frustrated, there was no paternal relative in the database of 23andMe. And my kids actually told me about this new company, Ancestry.com, that had been around for a while doing records for family trees. And they entered the DNA field and did some very, very splashy advertising on it. By 2017, I was looking at the advertising for Black Friday specials, $49. I had spent $999 9 years ago as a new customer of 23andMe. So I was very excited to go off and do my DNA test through Ancestry.com. And through that, some 22 years after learning that I was donor conceived, I found the source of my seed.
And I take it probably deceased?
Deceased. He was deceased the year that I discovered that I was donor conceived, actually, 2 months before I discovered I was donor conceived, I learned that he was 86 at the time, and was deceased. My mom at the time was 75, and my dad, had he been alive, would have been 90.
The whole concept of DNA testing, all the research that can go into that, you're still bound by the fact that you were the product of secrecy, or the facts were secret. If a person doesn't know, or doesn't actually go into a DNA database, they would never know either.
So I started my book with this Buddha quote, three things are certain to appear, the sun, moon, and the truth. That truth is going to come out somehow or other, eventually.
Have you ever tried MyHeritage?
Yes.
Okay. I recently interviewed a genealogist, and she talked about those of us, because I'm one of them, with European English background, that people in Europe use MyHeritage much more than they do the North American ones.
Yes, and 23andMe also is used largely by Eastern Europe, more so than Ancestry.com.
Okay.
There's a way now you can take your DNA results and get the raw data and download them to any site. So I'm on MyHeritage, even though I never took the test through MyHeritage.
Yeah, I understood that. Is there any way to make this a viable process? Like, can you see a way to make sure that information is passed on, like the important information? Like perhaps that person's name or age, whatever, may not be as important, but their genetic background, anybody else that's, you know, how far have they donated, all that sort of stuff. Is there any way to bring that together?
Well, you know, let me back up a little bit. Mark Twain once said something like, the two most important days of your life are the day you were born and the day you discovered why. I must have discovered why, because now I consider myself an author and a significant advocate for the rights of the donor conceived. So the donor conceived Bill of Rights, for which I advocate some regulation, would say that anonymity is gone, so let's just have open donor only. Require donor genetic testing and the release of health history. Limit the number of siblings, the number of offspring per donor. With frozen sperm today, you have the ability to have well over 100 siblings. How is that right? How about create a sibling registry? A registry so that these half siblings all know of one another. Some required counseling for both the donor as well as the recipient regarding the needs of the donor conceived. Then some legal consequences for this blatant fertility fraud that does exist. By blatant fertility fraud, I mean possibly a doctor deciding to use his own sperm as opposed to donor sperm on countless numbers of patients. That has happened. Most times today, or a donor claiming that he has a PhD and speaks six languages, but really he's a convicted felon in a schizophrenic case. So some legal consequences for this. There is no legal consequences for anything in this whole field. It's self-regulated, self-policed. Now, we know that the SEC and the FDA and the ITC and all these initials are organizations created for the public good, provide some regulatory oversight. But here we have an industry, multi-billion-dollar industry today, the fertility industry, that operates like the Wild West with no regulatory oversight. Now, I have a friend that used to breed Rottweilers, and I went to him, and as I was researching this whole field, and told him what I had discovered, and he said, you know, Pete, there's more regulatory oversight to breeding puppies than to conceive human beings. That's unfathomable. And when he said that to me, I thought, well, this could be a pretty thought-compelling book that my research is. But I couldn't write the book until I finished my story. And I couldn't finish my story until I found my heritage, found my real source of my genes on Ancestry.com in 2017. Once I did that, I thought I would have a an interesting book that would be both a very intimate, deeply intimate memoir, as well as a tell-all expose on an industry that's just totally out of control.
The factors that might go into sperm donation are probably not legislatable. You know, you can take money out of the picture, like for a hungry college student, something like that. But someone who just needs to know that, you know, they've procreated, whatever the hell, it's pro, created umpteen or hundreds, as you just said, of offspring, like the psychology behind a donor. How do you regulate for that?
You know, there's regulation now protecting blood donation, regulation for organ donation. Are there violations? Yes, but there's legal consequences. So I would be advocating some regulation and some oversight on this. And it's bigger than just sperm donation now. It's almost trafficking in the egg field. There are forces that are in, for instance, Eastern Europe, victimizing young, disenfranchised, poor women, feeding them with drugs to promote their egg production, harvesting those eggs, freezing them, and then selling them internationally to the highest bidder. There are regulations preventing somebody from taking an organ and doing that. Does it happen? Sure it does, but there's at least some legal oversight to it.
And I suppose going into the egg donation for a moment is, if this is a poverty-stricken girl in a developing country, chances are she will never, ever be registered at Ancestry or MyHeritage.
She may not. Maybe a relative would. Who knows? Third cousin. It's all it takes.
Yeah, yeah. The genealogist that I spoke to talked about, because she knows what she's doing. It was pretty interesting. She talked even, the minute you have a name, even places you can go with social media today to track through, and, you know, friend lists, that sort of thing. Suddenly you see another name and you go, yeah, like, okay, and you can follow. But yeah. I don't know, is that reliable? And I guess, I mean, obviously she's a professional, she knows what she's doing, but I guess just in my mind, and obviously you've done your research, there's still so many unknowns or dead ends.
Lots of unknowns and lots of dead ends, most certainly. But this is now a bigger thing. It's not only donor conception. There's a term called NPE, non-parental experience. You can be an NPE because your DNA and your birth certificate just don't jive. Something is askew. Well, donor conception is a good example of that. But how about closed adoption? A lot of people are adopted and didn't know it. How about an extramarital affair, a one-night stand, or a sexual assault, reported or unreported? There are people that were raised by Aunt Martha thinking they were mom, but really Cousin Mary was mom, raised by another family member. That happens in families even today. Or switched at birth. Pundits believe that some 1 in 20 of in the DNA database have learned that they are not what they thought they were from a parenting standpoint. 1 in 20. The number used to be 2 to 4%, and then the pundits would argue about that. Some thought it was much higher, some lower, but they circled on 4% as a number that they could talk to. Well, here Pew Research has done the research on the 50 million people in the DNA database, and they found 1 in 20, so that's 5% by the old math. Also, over 20% of those in the DNA database, according to Pew Research, have learned that something new in their heritage because of DNA? Was it in their grandparents, or did they have a sibling or a cousin they didn't know about? So there's no place to run, no place to hide anymore. All these family secrets are being exposed.
I actually mentioned that a curiosity, I guess because of all the DNA testing and everything we've heard about, is I've often wondered, because my dad was in Italy during the war, whether or not, you know, because you hear about all the stresses of war and what might go on, in terms of, and I've never done DNA testing. Do you know how many people have actually gone into that? Like your original $995 would be really prohibitive to most people. $49 might not be. I don't know what it is these days, but
That's $35, $39, depending on the sale, the Mother's Day sale or what have you. The number used to be $49, now it's $39 from a sales standpoint. The list price is still $99, but they've done some other things to separate some of the components of DNA so they can make more money out of it. But 50 million people in the database, 20% of them having a DNA surprise is a lot of people. Now, my case is this. I believe that DNA will, this consumer marketplace for DNA today is just market entry. And the real practice for DNA will be personalized medicine. But I can take this out just a decade. I can foresee a, hear me out on this. I can foresee a kiosk in CVS Pharmacy or Walgreens. You go in and spit in a vial, stick it in the machine along with your credit card, get an instant readout as to which vitamins on the shelf would be specific to the DNA component of your body. Now with that, you'll have some unintended consequences. I can see two brothers walking into a kiosk and spitting it for that vitamin content to improve their athleticism. And they're looking at the results and gonna do what I did. I have to pick up the phone and say, Mom, we have to have a talk, because something is askew. Now, there's a therapist that should specialize in trauma and identity trauma, having experienced it firsthand, is very real. And I learned that new trauma, this identity trauma, rekindled old trauma that I had thought long past for me. My therapist said that I had hit a trifecta, that I had some disruption in my childhood that I never really dealt with, and my PTSD from Vietnam I never really dealt with. So I had all three of those things going on at the same time, the trifecta. I don't think the therapy community is prepared for the rush of trauma patients that they will have as a result of the pervasiveness of DNA will be and the impact that will have.
The reason that, or shall I say, by the time a person decides that sperm donation we'll go with same-sex couples, single women. By the time they make that decision, it's maybe just a question that you can't necessarily answer. Are they so, I won't say desperate, but anxious and enthusiastic and excited that they may not really think about getting all of that DNA information, including a sibling registry?
Well, you know, the sociology is significantly different today, and a good deal of the customer base for sperm bank, for instance, is a same-sex couple. Well, little kids know birds and bees, and all of the social research that has been done on this in the last 20 years, and there's been a plethora of research, all agree that it's in the best interest of a child just to know right up front that he or she is donor conceived. Part caregivers would work. When someone has two moms, it's pretty obvious. Given that that's part of his woodwork, as he grows, as a child grows, he can learn more and more. And he doesn't have that shock to the system like I did at age 49 or 35 or however age somebody is when they learn.
Yeah, that was in my notes, actually, that same sex and single parents can't really lie about assisted conception. I think you've touched on a few statistics, but how prevalent is this in the States? Like, go with the States. I'm in Canada, but I'm sure they're comparable.
Statistically, 15% of couples have fertility issues. Half with the man, half with the woman, and 20% of them a combination of things. So that's a big marketplace. Fertility is a big marketplace. There is research now that states that 50 decades, fertility has decreased by 50%. 50% decreased. Why could that be? Well, combination of a toxic environment, and the fact that people are just waiting longer and the biological clock is not working on their behalf. So if fertility rates are down 50%, we also have statistics put out by the American Society of Reproductive Medicine that the population of donor-conceived people, children, in the last decade has increased by 50%. So in 2010, there was some research done, and they thought that the adult population was about 1 million people worldwide donor-conceived. Well, here in the last decade, you have 500,000 new people donor-conceived their children on top of the 1 million adults. Now, less than 10% of the 1 million adults really know that they're donor-conceived. Most of those kids, I think, do. So, totally different environment today.
I remember a number of years ago having the conversation with my son, who was watching some of his friends get married and have difficulty procreating. And, you know, he said, like, why do you think that is, Mom? And, of course, I had my theories at the time. But for someone who's looked into it, it's interesting hearing what you're saying. The other question I wanted to ask you was about migration, because it seems now migration is huge compared to what it was 100 years ago.
It is and it isn't. A fossil was found in Europe a couple of years back, a human fossil, and the discoverers thought it would be interesting to with DNA search for a relative. So here is this fossil, 20,000 years old. They found a relative 12 miles away.
Okay. So that family didn't go far. It's a little crazy. I don't want to go into U.S. politics, but do you have any scuttlebutt on what might become of assisted reproduction under the new administration? When I got the information at the very beginning, when I read the definition of art, that CDC website actually says there's a little flag at the top saying it's being modified, in quotations. Do you see a future, and I don't mean just the existence of, but what do you see as the future currently?
Well, there are advocacy organizations working on this donor-conceived Bill of Rights. In the last few years, 13 states have adopted legislation addressing fertility fraud specifically. The state of Colorado was most recently the one who enacted the donor-conceived Bill of Rights regarding anonymity testing, limitations to the numbers of siblings, a requirement of a registry, the counseling, and the penalties for blatant fertility fraud. There's been an action federally for legislation as well, but I think federally, Congress is just so dysfunctional right now. it's a little hard to predict. So the advocacy organizations have gone state to state, trying to do this on a state legislative basis, building up enough momentum so it will be taken care of federally, just by osmosis. Now, we have 500 members of Congress, approximately, between the Senate and the House of Representatives. If 5% of the universe is attributed, let's do the math, and eventually, all it takes is one member of Congress learning that he or she, too, is donor-conceived, and we'll have a champion in court.
I'm going to go back to the database for a minute, or I guess genetic testing is, and again, I'm only showing my lack of knowledge about genetic testing, but is there a way, or is there currently genetic testing done on the sperm that's donated to check for like drastic psychological issues or health issues or, I don't know, any of those things that could impact the health and well-being of a child that comes out of sperm donation?
Scientifically, there can be. And at times, that does happen. There is no law stating that this must happen. And that therein lies my issue. It's a voluntary thing as opposed to the law.
Tell us about, I'm going to have to scroll down my notes here, the U.S. Donor Conceived Council. Is that something that you actually started or that you're just a really important part of?
I am a founding contributor of the U.S. Donor Conceived Council, but it was envisioned by a group of donor conceived people that felt as violated as we all did regarding practices, and they decided to band together and do something about it. So it's a 100% volunteer organization funded as a nonprofit. So I am a founding contributor of USDCC. I've done some testifying on behalf of the USDCC, but I'm not a member of their management team. I'm simply a volunteer. A supporter.
Where do they want their future to go?
Well, they're working towards the Donor-Conceived Bill of Rights. Okay. State to state, but eventually federal legislation.
What? I came in here admitting I didn't know much about it. What haven't I asked you, or what haven't we touched on that is a really important piece of this subject? I'm going to say puzzle, but I think we'll stick with subject.
Yeah, good question. Sometimes I get asked, Agnes, what would have happened to me if I never found out my heritage? How would I have dealt with that? In Vietnam, I was a special operations team leader, and oftentimes we had PSYOPs missions. And one of the PSYOPs missions was Operation Wandering Soul. It was a nighttime mission, very dangerous. And we would play upon the superstition of Buddhist that if they died and their body was not returned to the family ancestral burial ground, they would forever wander. And I would, I think that sometimes I would be that wandering soul, forever wandering, looking my ancestral roots.
I think, too, it's an impossible question to answer for sure, but it's not just about you. You have children and grandchildren, and I'm going to use my little air quotes, the mystery, it can continue on for generations.
Tell my kids to make certain that my grandchildren, when they get to be dating age, scope things out. Now, stranger things have happened. Now, I'm not likely to have 100 siblings. I was part of the fresh sperm, not the frozen sperm generation. My parents used a very ethical practitioner who wasn't using his own sperm on countless dozens or hundreds of patients. But I'm not likely to have 100 siblings. Now I know my heritage, I know my health history, and I know a few siblings. The question that I have that will never be answered ever, how many siblings do I have really? Knowledge is power. I want my grandchildren and their children to understand some of the issues that they have as baggage from my heritage and just deal with them properly. You can't fix what you can't see. Just be aware.
I suppose, too, there's always the option that that sperm donor went on and had legitimate children that he raised.
I have a half-sibling that is actually the legitimate sibling of the donor.
Once again, that must be, whether it's traumatic or just plain weird, for that person as well.
Sure. You know, she had never realized that her father was a donor.
So it's almost like it's a hornet's nest that's even bigger than you imagine today. But you know, the more conversations that happen, it's almost like the bigger the hornet's nest gets.
Well, you know, I got really lucky. I hit a home run in terms of finding a offspring of my donor who championed helping me determine who that donor was. Oftentimes, people will circle the wagon and push back and put up a wall. But I found someone who embraced me, so it was really a home run.
Tell us about your book, Uprooted.
Well, like I said, when I started researching this, and my friend said to me, "Gosh, I breed Rottweilers, and there's more regulatory oversight to breeding puppies." I thought this could be a very compelling book about a tell-all expose about the industry. But I had to finish my story, and once I did, I did it as a combination of an intimate memoir of someone who learned that he was not quite what he thought he was, as well as the sociological, scientific, and legal history and evolution of an industry that's now a multi-billion-dollar industry off the rails. Titled Uprooted: Family Trauma, Unknown Origins, and the Secretive History of Artificial Insemination. It's available on my website, www.peterjvonnie.com. It was published 3 years ago. It's received some recognition as well. Declared the best narrative nonfiction and that sort of thing. Oprah hasn't called me yet.
Do you want me to phone her?
Sure.
As soon as we're done.
Anybody trying to help me is a friend.
There we go.
My friends tease me now. They say, "Well, they say Brad Pitt and George Clooney have turned the role down, but Danny DeVito said yes."
You could do worse. Come on. Oh dear. So what else is? I'm just curious about this book because it sounds like there are so many. Obviously, your personal angle is the obvious and the most important. But you have done decades of research. You have, it sounds, lobbied is the right word, is it, or the wrong word? I don't know about this.
Lobbied is a word.
Is it workable in this situation?
I think I had three goals for my book when I started to write it. First of all, I'm all for science to enable wanting people to have a child. If practiced with some consideration for the child created by the science. So positively impact the whole practice of assisted reproductive technology was a goal and still is. Number one. To influence the legislative agenda for that donor-conceived Bill of Rights is a goal, number two. And number three, speak to the needs and the emotional well-being of all people that learn they are misattributed for whatever the reason. It comes with baggage, and it comes with trauma. And just because you're semi-adopted, or you learn that you're the product of an extramarital affair, it's still a shock to the system. And only those that really walk in those shoes really get it. Only those who walk that walk really understand what it is. So speak to the needs and the emotional well-being of many people that are walking in that walk. Or will learn by accident that they are not quite what they thought.
Is there ever going to be a day, and obviously you can't do anything about extramarital affairs and that sort of thing, but will sperm donation, egg harvesting, is that part of our future now?
It's been a part of it for over 100 years, so most certainly. If you believe the pundits that fertility is decreasing by 50% over the last four decades, you do that on a graph, and that's a going out of business curve, right? That's impacting the longevity of the human race.
Can you regulate, maybe this is part of what you are doing, regulate the money behind sperm donation to keep it a bit more ethical?
That's the idea. You know, this is all about money. And like I said, we had the SEC and the FDA and the ITC and a lot of initials as regulatory organizations, because industries have shown that they don't police themselves all that well. This is just another example.
They don't police themselves because it's not in their financial best interests?
Definitely.
Oof, okay. What else do you want our listeners to know?
I'll be happy for a review, and I'll be happy for a recommendation for other people to read my book.
Yeah, I have thoughts in my closing thing, but it's pretty crazy. Where do we find you on the World Wide Web? You said Peter J. Bonney?
I'm www.peterjbonney.com.
Okay. I was looking at your website. You are on social, sort of?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm on Instagram and X.
Those busy people. Okay. Website link is in the show notes. All of the links are on your page at our website. Listeners, what do you think about my conversation with Peter today? It's been super thought-provoking for me. Several weeks ago, I talked to a genealogist, and we discussed sperm donation. We agreed that it was the right of the sperm donor to maintain his anonymity. But after today, I truly understand why that shouldn't hold.
Science doesn't agree.
Before we clicked record, it was just like, holy crikey, I was doing my research and listening to you and looking at your website, and I was going like, oh my God, this is like a changes the picture completely. And I think on that vein, perhaps another reason why people should buy your book, because it's really easy to see the beneficial side of sperm donation. But you come at it from a totally different or additional side, which I think I didn't take into consideration. I'm sure I'm not the only one that didn't take that into consideration.
You know, Agnes, I've spoken before a variety of fertility specialists in their practices, and their terminology for somebody like me is I'm a successful outcome. Right, and once that successful outcome of pregnancy happens, they just wash their hands, they're done. All right, so this opened up their eyes too about what impact does that have on someone who is a successful outcome.
It must be strange when you go from being a relatively normal functioning adult to being a statistic.
Well, I still am a relatively functional.
But I just mean that you have this added thing. I don't think I ever thought of myself as a statistic, but
Well, hence the need for some advocacy on my part.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I guess I was just allowing you that. Yeah, I have friends whose children are the product of sperm donation, but they've been completely honest with their children and have made extensive genetic inquiries about the sperm donor, and they are part of a sibling registry.
Really heartening to hear. That's encouraging. What I learned in dealing with my own trauma, by the way, on this is a five-part program that I've got to deal with this. First of all, just acknowledge the trauma to begin with. You can't fix what you can't see. Just acknowledge it. Secondly, seek all the information you can about it. Thirdly, get some help. Support organizations, professional help, therapy. I went the therapy route at the behest of my family and my friendship circle. And I was part of the old school that thought that therapy is not for me. In the war room and in the boardroom, I saw that if you're weak and needy, maybe you're unfit for command. I first learned this, I was a CEO. Discreetly sought my therapist and went through a few of them before I cycled into the right one. So get some help. Fourthly, forgive yourself and others. It's hard to overcome anything if you're harboring some anger for a long period of time. Forgive. And lastly, leave. I'm blacking out.
The five-part program, is that something that people can find on your website, or is this just something that you have?
It's in my research, in my interviews as well. It's just okay. To heal, is what I'm looking for. To heal, I had to reveal. The reveal is healing all by itself. And my book, I found to be very revealing and very healing for me. And now I'm into actually part six, and that is helping some others deal with the trauma, that five-part program, which I find very gratifying all by itself. When I get a reader coming to me to say, boy, this really made an impact. Thank you. And that's really a lot of... a lot of fortification for the energy to write a book to begin with.
We've gone into quite a bit of your personal story. May I ask you one more personal question?
Sure.
What do you have to forgive yourself for?
Good question. At the time that I learned that I was donor conceived, I was 49 years old, my wife and I were going through a marital crisis. So in addition to navigating my personal trauma, I was navigating my marital crisis. My marital crisis was principally because of all of the childhood stuff that I had. I just told myself I was going to be strong and resourceful and energetic, and I would never be weak. I would be strong for my family. And what I did is I robbed my wife of a degree of intimacy. Me, emotional intimacy, because I could never express my anxieties or my fears. I always had to be strong. And that took some doing. But now I bonded with Popeye. I am what I am, but now I'm better than I am.
May I suggest, and only because we are not that far apart in years, that part of your holding yourself back, perhaps emotionally, was generational as well.
I'm sure, yeah. Not only generational, but there was some sex to position on that.
Okay, listeners. When honesty is the norm in your life, it's easy to forget that it isn't for many others. If you have thoughts on today's show, please talk to us. If questionable or mysterious genetics have shown up in your research, please share as much as you're comfortable sharing. Leave comments where you're listening, or if you're listening at boomwithabang.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and talk to us there. Also, check out Peter's website. There are a number of resources there if you want to dig a bit deeper. As well as buying this book, it sounds like that's just an epic way to start, to really jump in with both feet. Share this episode. Peter was 49 when he found out his truth. Perhaps a friend of yours has questions about their own genetic anomalies. This conversation might give them tips and some support for asking the hard questions. If you appreciated this conversation, click the follow button at your favorite podcast platform and help us grow. I'm also registered at Substack. Following there is free, and you get notified every time an episode is released. Peter J. Bonnie, thank you for being my guest today and giving us, but me for sure, so much to think about.
I appreciate the opportunity, Agnes.
Yeah. It's a service, and I'm using my air quotes again, that on the surface seems, and please forgive me my bad pun, it's a service that seems really productive, but can have huge repercussions. So thank you for sharing as much as you shared today.
Sure thing.
Have a great rest of the week.